Welcome to this Tuesday edition of Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Coming up a little bit later in today's show, I'll visit with Fargo filmmaker Stephanie Manzis, producer and director of Marked by Grace, Compassion Prevails on the World War II Battlefield. We'll discuss the inspiration behind her documentary, her team's diverse expertise, and the film's powerful exploration of humanity amid wartime atrocities. And Tom Ezrin will stop by with another of his Plains Folk essays. Dr. Ezrin reflects on the legacy of the Homestead Act and how historian Richard Edwards' new book, Great Plains Homesteaders, reshapes our understanding of this pivotal era, challenging both the myths and the harsh critiques of homesteading on the Great Plains. But first, following President Biden's recent formal apology for the U.S. government's role in Native American boarding schools, filmmaker Jeff O'Gara discusses his documentary, Home from School, The Children of Carlisle, which delves into this generational trauma and ongoing healing surrounding Native American boarding schools and a dark chapter in American history. Producer-director Jeff O'Gara is my guest, and in light of President Biden's recent formal apology for the United States government's role in Native American boarding schools, Jeff has created a film that I'd like to share with our viewers. Jeff is a former colleague and a mentor of mine at Wyoming PBS. Jeff, welcome to Main Street.
Craig, I'm glad to be here. And in fact, it's kind of a wonderful reunion from old Wyoming public media people.
Oh, it sure is, Jeff. And you're so wonderful to visit with. I feel the same. Your film shed light on the generational trauma and healing surrounding really this dark, dark chapter in our history. What motivated you to create your film, Home from School?
Well, there were a number of things, Craig. I think it starts with the fact that I had always found as a journalist, both in print and later in television, that the Wind River Reservation was kind of a great source of stories that hadn't been told yet. There are all kinds of reasons that's true. But in any case, I knew that, as you probably do too as a journalist, that this is a place where I could go and find things to write about, to do television about, that really hadn't been passed along to the general public much at all in the past. And in this particular case, I developed relationships over the years with a number of people in both the Northern Arapaho and Eastern Shoshone tribes. One of them was a guy named Mark Soldier Wolf. He'd been on the business council, the Arapaho Business Council. We'd become friends over the years. And I, in fact, remember his daughter coming with us, a young girl dancing at the Olympics in Salt Lake ages ago. At any rate, I knew the family, and his daughter, Yufna Soldier Wolf, called me and said, Jeff, there's kind of an interesting story developing here. We've been trying for years to get the remains of some young Arapaho boys who had been sent back in the 19th century to the Carlisle Indian School in Pennsylvania and died there and were buried in a cemetery in Pennsylvania. We've been trying for generations, actually, to get the remains of those children brought back to Wind River so they could be buried in their family cemeteries. And I think Yufna thought, you know, Jeff's a writer. He'll maybe do an article about this. The minute I heard that she and a delegation were going to go back to Carlisle, still uncertain whether the Army was going to release these remains or not, I thought, okay, let's put a camera on the plane. Let's go with them. Let's meet them there. There's going to be an important story here. So that's really how it came about. It was Yufna's approaching me with it. And immediately I was thinking, oh, I got to do this. It's a great story.
Jeff, when President Biden traveled to Arizona and he made his apology on behalf of the federal government for its role in Native American boarding schools, what went through your mind?
Well, let me be honest, Craig. I'm not a big one on these sort of governmental apologies. I'm not sure that they mean a whole lot unless they're coupled with some other things. I am a great believer in the truth and reconciliation processes, which have been used in South Africa and in this country. And what you're doing there is you're trying to say, we want to know the whole truth. We want to know our history, both the good and the bad of it, because we're going to learn from it. So again, I appreciate what the president was trying to do in rendering an apology to the tribes for the damage that was done to children in boarding schools. But I think much more important, it is much more important, I think, to unearth all of the history that we can and learn it, go in depth, and let everybody, not just Native Americans, but the entire American population, grow out of the knowledge of things like this. You know, we've made mistakes. We all know we've made mistakes. But sometimes the detail of those mistakes is what keeps us from making them again.
Why does it matter to this generation? Why is this an important issue yet today?
I think it's pretty simple. I think what you can say is the boarding schools are maybe the most extreme example of weaponizing education. In other words, if we have a problem with Native Americans, in fact, this was calculated back in the day, it's pretty expensive. It was pretty expensive in the 19th century to send out the army and kill a Native American in the Indian Wars. Turns out it was a whole lot cheaper to educate them. In fact, a senator back then in the 1880s ran a calculation and said, look, it may cost us $1 million to kill a Native American in the war. We can educate them for 6-7 years for $1,200. That's a good deal. And then we will have essentially Americanized them, at least in his words. We will have made them a little bit more conversant with our culture and our history, and we'll kind of erase the negatives that they may have in their, you know, their home life and their family life about the American culture and the way it's treated Native Americans. I may have gone off course there on that answer, but basically, this is the reason these things still matter, because education, you know, it can be a tool for simply knowing as much as you can and learning how to think analytically about what you're learning, or it can be used to kind of propagandize, and it can be used by limiting it to keep you from knowing things that really did happen, and because they really happened, they're worth knowing about.
Jeff, you and I are both older white men. How difficult was it for you to develop over a long period of time the respect that was required in order to bring this important story forward?
I'd use the word trust rather than respect. And all that means is I had come out to the reservation, boy, back in the 1980s and begun as a newspaper reporter covering things out there. And I'd asked for it as a beat with the Casper Star Tribune because I just knew there were a lot of stories that nobody was covering. What I learned very quickly is that the question with a journalist coming in, or an anthropologist, or anybody else who's not native, is, are you going to come back? Are you going to do what a lot of journalists do, not just on reservations, but where you parachute in, you know, to a war zone, or you parachute into a faraway place and you tell a story behind the lines, and then you leave again, and you go back to your comfortable home, wherever that might be. People are very observant on the Wind River Reservation, and I think on all reservations, of who comes to stay and who just comes to kind of grab a story and run away. And for whatever reason, over the years, I stayed, as you did, in Fremont County in Wyoming, covering stories on the reservation for a lot of different media. Gradually, people got used to me. They knew who I was. They knew my family. We didn't always socialize, but in some cases, we did. I never went in trying to become one of them. In other words, I didn't run in there saying, please take me to a sweat or adopt me into your family. I came in and said, look, I'm a journalist. I'm here for stories. And I think, again, over time, when they saw the stories that I wrote, that became a kind of trust. So, again, when you come years down the line to this opportunity to do a documentary about the boarding schools, it began with the fact that people just knew me, and they knew that I wasn't going to hop in there and, you know, steal an interview and then never show up again.
Enjoying our conversation with producer, director Jeff O'Gara, a longtime friend of mine. He's our guest today on Main Street. Jeff created the film Children of Carlisle about Native American boarding schools and then generational trauma and healing surrounding this dark chapter in our history and recovering remains and bringing them back to Wind River. Jeff, was this hard for you to research? Did you find that data and documents were available to you, or was that a tough go for you relative to what you needed to learn about and the permissions you needed to get for the project?
Well, two different things. The history could be researched, and this is partly because Dickinson College in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, had a program that had students going down to the National Archives and searching for school records and trying to find out what actually became of all the students there. And there are a number of histories that have been written, some of them good, some of them not so good, about the whole boarding school era, and certainly about the era of creation of reservations, the Indian Wars, all of the 19th century drama, really, that happened in the West. the problems we had had to do with access at the Carlisle School, which is now part of the Army War College in Pennsylvania. And so, you know, controlled access, they're very careful about who can come in and come out. And even though we had been invited to come by the delegation of Northern Arapaho that went to, and frankly, without the assurance that they were going to get the bodies of these children, they went. We would often find ourselves at the gate with a camera being told, you're not going to come in here. In fact, I remember one time we were at the same hotel. We were all staying at the same hotel. A cameraman and I got down under the backmost seat in the bus that would take the Northern Arapaho delegation into the complex where the cemetery was and hid. And only once we were inside through the gates did we get out and then get into the ceremonial tent. And at that point, the Army just couldn't come in and say, you know, we're going to drag you away. So again, that was our biggest problem, was getting access, getting any kind of comment, any kind of interviews with the Army about why they had resisted so long, allowing the tribe and other tribes to come back and retrieve the remains of their children.
Jeff, what feedback along the way have you gotten since the release of your film?
Oh, gosh. Well, you know, it's been a few years now, and the film ran on Independent Lens on PBS nationally and actually ran three times. And again, I'm going to pat all of us, I hope, on the back a little bit and say that it was their second highest rated show 2 years ago. So it got a lot of circulation. It got seen by a lot of people, but we got much more rewarding feedback when we did festivals and events. We would go to things like the Native American Education Conference, show the film. There would be, you know, 100, 200 people in the room. And after it was over, we'd have a little panel where myself and Jordan Dresser, who was an associate producer at Northern Arapaho, and others would be on the panel. But people in the audience would get up and they might ask a question, but a lot of times they would get up to testify. They would get up and say, you know, my grandfather was in Carlisle or one of the other Native American boarding schools. And by the way, there were, gosh, I think 37 or 40 federally sponsored boarding schools, as well as a number of religious boarding schools on reservations. Anyway, the most interesting and rewarding moments were when people would get up and say, here's my testimony. Here's what happened to me. It was very emotional for them. And we, in fact, offered at many of the screenings counseling for anybody who might need it.
Jeff, you lived in Lander while you and I knew each other in Wyoming, 23 miles away from me, who lived in Riverton. And of course, the vast Wind River Reservation was between us. In retrospect, it was astonishing to me how much I didn't know about either the Eastern Shoshone or the Northern Arapaho tribes, certainly while I was growing up, and my kids in the same boat, even today, even though they were our neighbors. Jeff, why is that?
Well, I'm certainly going to say that's not your fault, and except it's our fault in the sense that I was on a school board, and I think the schools are what's at fault, so I guess I will take some blame myself. You know, we don't teach this stuff. And there have been kind of incremental efforts to bring education, to bring some of the important histories of Native American tribes into the public schools, but it's halting and it's difficult. I mean, it's not, a lot of this is oral history. A lot of it's not written down. So it's not the easiest thing for someone to put together a lesson plan that tells your kids in Riverton, here's the story of how the Shoshone or the Arapaho came to this reservation, you know, back in the 19th century. Those are enormous stories. They're still being kind of mined and dug up. And then the question is, how do you get them into people's hands? But again, it's hard when you live next door to a reservation. You don't know what the rules are. You don't know if you can just wander out there and introduce yourself to someone. Turns out that, I won't name a name here, but when Berthina and I first moved to Lander, a local judge warned us, don't drive out on the reservation. It's really dangerous. I don't let my son go out there at all. Well, you know, I found that to be very untrue. In fact, I think some of the most welcoming people that I met in my time in Wyoming were on the Wind River Reservation.
But I'll second that. Absolutely.
Yep. And I, again, in defense of everybody who says, as you just did, hey, I just wasn't taught about anything. I just didn't. Again, that is not because you wouldn't have sought it out. It's because it wasn't offered.
What is the, I guess, historical impact that we experience even today from boarding schools and their history in our country.
You might say the last generation of Native Americans who were in boarding schools when they were still pretty much an attempt to, I don't know what you'd call it, I suppose they might use the word cleanse Native Americans of what was left of their culture and turn them into a more homogenized American. The last of that generation is growing old. In fact, a person who was very prominent in our film, Hugh Friday, just passed away. Hugh is a wonderful example of the kind of people that made a film like ours possible. I also say this, and this is to a degree in defense of what the motive behind some of the boarding schools. Hugh had a good experience there. He learned how to deal with the non-Indian world. He came back and was a real leader in his tribe. He knows that there was great harm done in the boarding schools in some instances, but his own experience was relatively positive. And I do think we can say even Carlisle was founded with the motivation of, you know, I mean, the famous phrase is, kill the Indian to save the man. It was with the idea of finding a way forward for Native Americans in the new society that essentially was going to dominate even inside the reservation. So I'm not sure where I'm going with that, except to say that there are still some of the people who suffered at the hands of the boarding school experience, but there are also some who did well with it. And today there are people, there are families I know on the Wind River who would say, I need my kid to get away from some really bad influences. I'm going to send him out to a federal boarding school in Oregon and give him a couple of years to kind of get his bearings, and hopefully then he'll come back and be able to contribute to our community.
Jeff, have you given thought to the future of Indigenous representation in film and media?
Given thought to it and also kind of watched it happening. We knew going into this project that we needed to not just feature Native Americans, we needed to bring them into our, if you will, creative team. And Jordan Dresser worked with me a great deal on Home from School. Our next production at Caldera Productions, the company that I run, is called, or was called, Who She Is. It's out now. It's about missing and murdered Indigenous women. And guess what? Jeff O'Gara is just the executive producer, which means I push the paper around. Jordan Dresser is the producer. And Sophie Barksdale did it with him. So that's the kind of thing that should happen. We all need to learn. I need to learn. And you and I both have been through this experience of learning to be a television person. Jordan needed to learn a little bit with me about how to make a film, and he did. He's a smart guy, and now he's making films of his own. Juwan Willow, who was one of the really teenagers in the film when we made Home from School, is now making films as well. So I guess that's what I would see to be the logical progression, and one that I find very desirable is, yeah, we get to steal a few stories from our Native American friends, but boy, the exchange ought to be they get to make the next story.
Jeff, are there more stories to tell? Are there more stories that you hope are told?
Oh, yeah. Oh, I mean, there are a bunch. And in fact, we're working on one now. So as you probably know, there's a lot of hoopla coming up about the 250th anniversary of the American Revolution. Ken Burns is out there making a big documentary about it. There'll be a lot of that. We're in the middle of working on a project called Parts Unknown, 1776 in the American West. And it's basically about another blank chapter in the American history books. We have all this stuff about the very dramatic and important events that were going on in the 13 colonies in 1776. But when you look at the European maps of the time, it literally says parts unknown when you look at the Dakotas, or you look at Wyoming, or you look at the Rockies. We're going to go, and we are going, and talking to tribes like the Eastern Shoshone, who are in the midst of their own revolution with the arrival of the horse, the Blackfeet with the arrival of the gun, all of the tribes with the arrival of smallpox. There was so much going on. So there's a great other story to tell. We're working on that one. We got a few others too, Craig, but you know, we're all the same. We've all got a sort of a packet of ideas that we're mining bit by bit.
Jeff, we certainly wish you the best. It's great to hear your voice again. My guest has been producer-director Jeff O'Gara. His film is Children of Carlisle. It sheds light on the generational trauma and healing surrounding the dark chapter in our history about Native American boarding schools. We bring it up today because of President Biden's recent formal apology of the U.S. government's role in Native American boarding schools. Jeff, it's a pleasure.
Thank you, Craig. I love it. I love talking to you.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Bill Dean, Realtor Broker with Alliance Real Estate of Bismarck. Buying, selling, investing, and estate planning. Information can be found at BillDeanHomes.com.
Main Street continues on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. In his next Plainsfolk essay, Tom Ezern reflects on the legacy of the Homestead Act and how historian Richard Edwards' new book, Great Plains Homesteaders, reshapes our understanding of this pivotal era, challenging both the myths and the harsh critiques of homesteading on the Great Plains.
If we're going to live in this level land we call the Great Plains, and I expect to do so until I die, then there are some fundamentals we need to come to terms with, like the Homestead Act, signed by Abraham Lincoln on the 20th of May, 1862. Unless we are indigenous, we should think about what it means to be the heirs of a landed settler society. Fortunately, we have Richard Edwards and his book, Great Plains Homesteaders, to help us out. This is the new slender volume in the University of Nebraska Press series, Discover the Great Plains. Edwards, the author, headed up the team of Nebraska scholars who conducted a deep data dive into the dynamics of the Homestead Act and published the results as Homesteading the Great Plains Toward a New History in 2017. Now that leaves Edwards free in the current work to tell stories and pose interpretations. What does this mean? Which you'll get if you're Lutheran or not. Why do we need a new history of homesteading? Because we have been telling stories about it that don't serve us well. Perhaps, I suggest timidly, we plains folk have been a little too vainglorious about our homesteading forebears. No, I don't think that's really Grover Cleveland's signature on the family patent you have framed, but it's nice to have that anyway. And the historians, on the other hand, have told a pretty gloomy story. As I learned it in college, the Homestead Act was a disaster. It was an ill-advised political scheme in the first place. Lots of people cheated, more of them failed, and it didn't really establish family farming by actual settlers the way it was supposed to. It destroyed the prairie environment to boot. Whereas Edwards, and he has the data, points out that the majority of claimants proved up. They succeeded, Edwards says, through some combination of smarter choices, harder work, more self-denial, and better luck. Moreover, he insists, they created a stable middle-class society of small property owners, and they left a lasting mark on American culture. Which is to say, short-term and long-term, the Homestead Act was a win for the settler society and for the country. Then, too, the new work on homesteading brings forward some elemental definitions and findings for us to reflect on and carry forward. For instance, the charting, which I mean literally with a nifty graph of homestead entries over time, the charting of the two great eras of homesteading on the plains. First, from 1868 to early 1990s, investing Kansas, Nebraska, and eastern Dakota Territory. Then, once the economic depression of the 1890s had passed, the second larger era of homesteading, sprawling across the higher and drier plains of Colorado, Montana, and North Dakota, with Montana as the epicenter. There were large generational differences between the two eras. Another important observation, the essential contributions of women to the success of homesteading. Single woman homesteaders perhaps have been given their due. Indeed, they were folk heroes in their own time. But the married women, the partners of male claimants, Edwards is the historian who truly sees them. Homesteading families were much more likely to be successful when the wife and husband formed a mutually supportive and complementary team, he concludes. I'll say more about this new history of homesteading. But for now, I'll just observe that Great Plains Homesteaders is a little book that would tuck into a Christmas stocking nicely.
That's our longtime friend, Dr. Tom Ezern, a distinguished professor of history at North Dakota State University. After the break, a film about compassion during World War II. That's after this.
Support is provided by Drs. Kirk Coyer and Phil Sondrel of Urgent Med, providing personalized walk-in medical care for all ages 7 days a week in South Fargo. Urgent Med, where urgent care doesn't feel like urgent care.
Welcome back to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Stephanie Mansis, she's the producer and director of the film Marked by Grace, Compassion Prevails on the World War II Battlefield. Stephanie, welcome to Main Street.
Thank you, Craig, so much for inviting me today.
Stephanie, what initially drew you to these stories of compassion between enemies on the battlefield during World War II? How did that inspire you, I guess, to begin to create this documentary?
Well, it started many, many years ago. I heard a story of compassion on the battlefield in World War II, and it was about a German soldier who was badly wounded, laying on the battlefield, looking at the sky, thinking that it was going to be his last final moments on this earth. And he looked up to see an American soldier looking down at him, and the American soldier grabbed him by the scruff of his uniform and dragged him several hundred feet to the German lines so that he would be found and rescued. The German survived, and he was in a hospital for 2 months, and he was left with a moral dilemma, Craig, because he was told he had to go back out and fight. And he didn't want to fight the Allied troops because an American had saved his life. And so he did go back and fight. And then fast forward 25 years later, he told his son, he had a teenage son, that he wanted him to go to America to find out how good Americans were. And his son went to America in a foreign exchange student. And I had heard this story from the family that he lived with.
Wow. How then did you go about your research, Stephanie, and then the ultimate selection of specific stories that you would like to include in the film? What qualities made them stand out to you?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I actually was going to do a book originally, Craig, of 15 stories of compassion between enemies on the battlefield, which is like finding 15 needles in a haystack. And I had a good friend's daughter who was very intuitive, and she said, Stephanie, I see you making a documentary. So after a couple months, I decided to make a documentary, even though I had no formal experience in filmmaking experience. And what I did is I just started to interview World War II veterans. I have probably interviewed on just audio tape about 62 World War II veterans and then 10 on camera. And I was specifically looking for those stories of compassion in the midst of war that we don't expect to find when we're talking about war.
You can't do a movie by yourself, then you probably also, and simultaneously maybe, had to embark on pulling a team together, Stephanie.
Yep, you're absolutely right. Because I'm a first-time filmmaker, I have surrounded myself with a fabulous crew of people who are very well-versed in making documentaries, and that has made the world a difference. So I have a team here in Fargo, as well as a team around the country, that helps me put this all together.
What's the process of the film so far? What have you done to date, and where do you see this going?
Well, to date, I have recorded 3 stories of compassion between enemies on the battlefield. One of them is actually a retired dentist here in Fargo, Dr. Morris Bonnemeyer. I share a story of his on the battlefield. And I have a 4th story that I'm recording in California in about 12 days. And I have 3 more days of filming, one in Southern California that I mentioned to you, one in Northern California. And then actually there's 4 all total. And then there's 1 in Germany and 1 in Fargo in January. And then when I'm done with the filming, I will move to editing. And my hope is to have this done next year.
It's certainly a tough, tough process to pull it all together, I'm sure. I'm most interested, Stephanie, I've had the honor of interviewing veterans for many different parts of the work that I've done in the past to watch their experience in recounting stories. What has touched you about the experiences you've seen the veterans react to as they're giving you their heart, their stories?
Well, I've been very honored that veterans have been willing to share with me, and I've been most touched by how emotional they get in the middle of an interview. And my experience, Craig, is that a lot of times World War II veterans, as they get older, they want to talk about it more when they're 80s and 90s. A lot of them never said a word about it when they were much younger in their lives. And my also experience has been that they're more likely to talk to a compassionate stranger than to talk to their own children. And I think my guess is it's because they don't want to get emotional and break down and be vulnerable in front of their children. So I've been very honored with the stories that I've had, and it really brings them back into the moment. You can see it in their eyes. And I'm very blessed that they're willing to share these stories with me.
What is in your mind on how this film will resonate with people who maybe have forgotten so much about war and World War II?
Well, I'm hoping it resonates with them because when we think about war, we think of the horrific atrocities that happen on the battlefield, and we don't think about compassion. So I'm hoping this will be sort of a surprise to people when they hear about it and will get them thinking, you know, if two men or a man and a woman can lay down their weapons on a battlefield and choose not to fight, what does that mean kind of in a bigger global area when it comes to the issue of peace? And I feel like in the middle of all the conflict that's surrounding this world, that this is a very timely documentary that needs to get out.
I think I very much agree with you there. We are enjoying our conversation with Stephanie Mansis. She's the producer and director of the film Marked by Grace, Compassion Prevails on the World War II Battlefield. Stephanie, what are your ties to North Dakota?
Well, I moved a lot when I was young because of my dad's career, but I actually went to junior high and high school at Ben Franklin in Fargo North. So, and then I've moved a lot also as an adult, Craig. I've lived, I think last count, I've lived in 26 different cities, states, and countries. So I've been kind of a nomad life, but I came back to Fargo as an adult 15 years ago, and it's very much my hometown.
How difficult is it for you, Stephanie, trying to do a project like this that you hope has national legs on places like PBS or the Discovery Channel, the History Channel, perhaps? How difficult is that for you to manage living here?
Well, it works out well here. I have a really wonderful, supportive team of mentors that are mostly from Fargo. One is from Grand Forks. And they all have film experience, which is very much helpful, or experience with veterans. And in terms of getting a national, you know, eye on this documentary, it's really kind of had me up my game so that I make sure that the director of photographies that I work with, which are the camera people, the editors, the film composers, are all top notch. Some are from Fargo and some are from outside of the Fargo area. To make a documentary that is of a level that a PBS or History Channel or Discovery Channel would be interested in it.
So how do you then plan to market it locally here in North Dakota? I've read maybe perhaps there are kiosks that you're considering, maybe some other things too?
Yes. The kiosk in Grand Forks has expressed an interest. I spoke to them several years ago about doing it on their kiosk. So I'm hoping that will come to fruition. I also want to do, once the documentary is done, do viewings around North Dakota and Minnesota in several communities, small and large. And then I'll be applying to film festivals for the first year after the documentary is done. And I'm trusting that I'll get into the Fargo Film Festival, which would be really wonderful.
I'm guessing that your audience will bend older, but you're hopeful, I'm sure, that you also reach a younger audience. How do you think that they'll respond, Stephanie, when maybe this is the first time they've considered something so dramatic as the stories you're going to present to them from World War II that now happened so long ago?
Well, that's a good question, Craig. I'm not sure I know the answer to that. I'm hoping that they will respond with surprise, again, that these stories actually could happen during World War II. And I'm hoping they can connect them to our present-day wars and see that there is a correlation and that World War II needs to be remembered. And my fear is, with the younger generation, that it's not being remembered. And so this is a way to help bring something with a more positive twist in front of them that they may be more and more likely to be engaged with.
Stephanie, one side of filmmaking that those of us as consumers rarely think about, I think, is the fact that these are not inexpensive to make. How do you go about raising funds to support what you believe, and I think what will become an important film?
Yeah, thanks, Craig, for that question. The fundraising is actually the most challenging part. I've had to learn a lot to up my skills in filmmaking, and yet this fundraising keeps me on my toes. I've had a lot of veterans organizations, including AMVETS, VFW, and American Legion, that have been very supportive. A lot of individuals have been very supportive. All of the donations are tax deductible, which helps out if people are inclined to want to donate. And that's kind of where I am. I'm right now in the middle of raising $37,500 for phase three of the documentary, which is for the 4 days remaining of filming and the editing.
No easy task, I'm sure. you have, I guess, secured the services of a narrator who I think we might recognize, Stephanie. Give us more background there.
Yeah, absolutely. Peter Coyote, who is the voice behind Ken Burns' documentaries, is doing our narration. In fact, if viewers or listeners, I should say, go to the website zenlilyfilms.com. That's ZenLilyFilms.com, zenlilyfilms.com. They can listen to our 3.5-minute trailer, and it has Peter Coyote's voice on it. And actually, Craig, when I reached out to Peter Coyote to do the narration, I didn't know who he was, and I was emailing him back and forth. It was probably a godsend that I didn't know who he was, because I'm not sure I would have reached out to him. And we were able to come to an agreement for the fee for the project, and I was thrilled to get him on board because he is one of the most recognizable voices in the States and perhaps around the world.
In the short term, Stephanie, where are you going next then with this film? What do you have right on your plate here in the next week or two?
I'm actually leaving to California tomorrow, and I will be filming the World War II veteran that I mentioned to you in November, as well as I'm going to the American Film Market in Las Vegas, where I'll be talking to distributors and buyers about my project.
How does that work, Stephanie? Do you just approach them, give them some assets to look at, perhaps a trailer? Or is it all about networking at that point?
I think part of it's about networking. I'm actually in the middle of preparing for the film market. So part of it is just bringing my phone with a little trailer on there for 3 minutes that they can watch, having a one sheet page about the documentary, and then sitting down with them and seeing if they have an interest in airing it or using it in streaming down the road.
It's a wonderful time to remember veterans, but certainly, Stephanie, stories like yours remind us we should be remembering the service and sacrifice of those who have fought for our country every day.
Absolutely. I would agree with you, Craig. And even though I've had the opportunity and the honor to interview so many veterans, I still don't understand at all how veterans can go to war and be in the combat zone and come back and live a normal life. That's completely, it's completely not understandable to me, even though I've had so much experience around veterans. And so I'm always very honored that veterans are willing to share their stories and very grateful that they have done what they have done for our country.
Stephanie Mansis, she's the producer and director of the film she's creating. The film is titled Marked by Grace, Compassion Prevails on the World War II Battlefield. Stephanie, this is an important project, and we certainly wish you the best.
Thank you so much, Craig. Thanks for inviting me today.
More Main Streets ahead. Stay with us.
Could China now become a green superpower? That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
After the U.S. election, one country is now situated to become the world's leader in renewable energy and maybe move away from fossil fuels, China.
China produces most of the world's solar and wind capacity and leads in electric vehicle sales. However, it's also the world's largest greenhouse gas emitter and has been reluctant to set climate targets for reducing emissions despite recent pressure from the U.S., low-lying island nations, and other Western countries.
With the election, China will have the opportunity to fill a leadership vacuum left by the U.S. as the second Trump administration has vowed to withdraw from the Paris Climate Agreement and drill, baby, drill. Trump also wants to cut electric vehicle subsidies.
Attracta Mooney of the Financial Times told WBUR that China could now become the world's green superpower. And as Bloomberg reports, Chinese companies have already been investing in renewable energy factories in the global south.
In addition to China, the European Union could help lead the world's efforts to sustainability. In the last 5 years, wind and solar capacity has grown in Europe by 65%, and greenhouse gas emissions have dropped.
Following the election, what could happen to water regulations? We can look both to Trump's first term as well as the Project 2025 report, the conservatives' roadmap for a Republican president.
As Bloomberg Law reports, in Trump's first term, the administration moved to reduce regulations based on the Clean Water Act and made it difficult to oppose construction projects that affected wetlands and waterways.
It seems likely that Trump would seek to undo water protections finalized last month by the Biden administration to mandate that all lead drinking water pipes be removed by 2027.
Biden's EPA set the country's first drinking water standards for six types of PFAS compounds last April after determining that almost no level of exposure is safe.
Project 2025 calls to revisit the designation of PFAS compounds as hazardous substances and says chemicals should be regulated only after they cause harm versus a policy of allowing just the chemicals that have been proven safe to be in use.
Rivers and watersheds could be at risk from spills, leaks, and accidents, according to the organization American Rivers, as Project 2025 suggests lifting the ban on fossil fuel extraction on federal lands.
Project 2025 calls for the dismantling of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, which shapes international ocean, fisheries, climate, and weather policies, and that could leave the country vulnerable and unprepared for future hurricanes, storms, floods, or drought.
And speaking of drought, from the last week of October and into early November, almost all of the U.S. faced drought conditions, with the exception of Alaska and Kentucky.
Remarkably, the Southeast was in drought, even after Hurricane Helene inundated the region, because there's been more evaporation with warmer temperatures and not much rain.
Evaporation plays a major role in drought, particularly in the U.S. West, according to a new study from UCLA. During the exceptional drought from 2020 to 2022, scientists found that reduced precipitation caused only one-third of the severity, and evaporation could be blamed for the rest.
The evaporation is a result of high temperatures caused by climate change, the authors say. Historically, western droughts have been caused by lack of rain and snow, and evaporation played a small role. Now, climate change means more water is evaporating not only from lakes and reservoirs, but also from soils and plants.
The lead researcher said that even if precipitation were normal, there's not enough water to keep up with evaporation, and building bigger reservoirs won't help because more moisture will be sucked up.
And finally, when Mount St. Helens erupted in 1980, lava incinerated every living thing for miles around.
Once the ash and debris cooled, scientists wanted to help regenerate plant and animal life on the mountain. So they brought in volunteers, not human ones, but animals often maligned by gardeners, the gopher.
In 1983, two researchers, one from UC Riverside and the other from Utah State University, helicoptered into a region where the lava had turned the land into slabs of pumice and only a few plants had managed to begin anew.
They set up two test plots and unleashed a few northern pocket gophers and let them burrow for just one day, the theory being they would move deep soil with its beneficial bacteria and fungi to the surface, which would jumpstart plant recovery.
The results were astonishing. In the short span of 24 hours, the rodents had started a chain reaction that would transform the area. Within 6 years, there were 40,000 plants thriving on plots where the gophers dug, while nearby untouched land was mostly barren.
Now, in a recent study, and over four decades later, the gopher's gift keeps on giving. Samples taken from the plots indicated better soil health where they had worked.
The takeaway, when it comes to restoration efforts, if in doubt about the value of nature-based solutions, we should probably just go for it.
That's it for this week in water. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public.
This is Bird Note. There are a lot of birds named after people. Just to name a few, there's Bachman Sparrow, Townsend's Warbler, and Audubon's Oriole. Lifelong birder Jordan Rutter, along with others in the birding community, recently dug into the history of the people behind the many eponymous names. And what they learned is unsettling. John Bachman was a vehement anti-abolitionist. John Kirk Townsend desecrated the graves of Native Americans. John James Audubon, considered the father of American birding, bought and sold enslaved people.
I honestly feel embarrassed that I have used these names and didn't know their history. They're these verbal statues that are casting shadows on the birds that we all just want to enjoy.
Jordan helped start and organize the campaign Bird Names for Birds. Their goal is to discontinue the use of these honorific names and replace them with names that celebrate the unique attributes and behaviors of the birds.
It's much easier for new birders, especially, to remember them. When I say, what does a Townsend warbler look like? You have no idea unless you actually are familiar with that bird. There's a way for us to remember and learn the history of ornithology and what people have contributed to it that can be separate from the actual birds. And just let birds be celebrated for birds.
You can read a longer interview with Jordan at our website, birdnote.org. I'm Mark Bramhill.
This is Dakota Datebook for November 12th. Great legacies can have small beginnings. This includes varsity hockey at the University of North Dakota. In 1908, the University of North Dakota's student newspaper, The Student, asked, "How would you like to have at your disposal, morning, noon, and night, an open-air rink, 200 by 150 feet, in good condition, where you could play hockey or just have a good time?" The student responded, "This is very possible if every lover of skating will get out and work to organize a skating club." The newspaper praised skating as the most healthful, invigorating exercise there is, and when it has the advantage of being participated in on an open-air rink, it is doubly healthful and pleasant. It described constructing a skating rink as a glorious dream, which owes its origin to Dr. Stewart. At the time, Dr. George Walter Stewart was the head of UND's physics department from 1903 to 1909. His dream was to erect a permanent rink costing about $5,000, large enough to maintain a hockey rink, a skating rink, a curling rink, and two large dressing rooms. The goal was to eventually convince the North Dakota State Legislature to fund an ice rink at UND, but that didn't happen. The next year, Dr. Stewart would accept a position at the University of Iowa and become a celebrated professor and founding chair of its physics department. Although Dr. Stewart's vision wasn't fully accepted in 1909, by the 1930s, intramural hockey flourished at the University of North Dakota. In 1931, the Dakota Student published an editorial asking UND's administration to spare hockey from massive budget cuts due to the Great Depression. In 1936, a new winter sports building was constructed with federal funding from the New Deal's Works Progress Administration. This building, affectionately known as the Old Barn, would support varsity hockey in future decades. By the time Dr. Stewart retired as a physics professor in 1946 at the University of Iowa, his dream of an ice rink and a hockey team at the University of North Dakota, which he had planted decades earlier, was about to come true. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Andrew Alexis Varvel. I'm Ann Olquist.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Hi, I'm Todd McDonald. I've been a reporter at Prairie Public for nearly 22 years. And while that sounds like a long time, compared to Dave Thompson and some of the other fine folks behind the scenes who've been here hundreds of years, if you add them all up, I still feel like a junior guy. And that's really a testament to this organization. People want to work here and to stay working here. Prairie Public is mission-driven. And here in the news department, the aforementioned Dave Thompson, as well as Danielle Webster and Katie David, are dedicated to informing you and everyone in our community with accurate, reliable facts and information. We're all proud to call Prairie Public home and to connect you, our valued listener, to the news you need to know.
And that's a wrap for today's edition of Main Street. We are deeply grateful that you've spent time with us here on Prairie Public. Tomorrow on the show, we'll travel to Grand Forks and visit with Jennifer Watney,
She's an aerospace physiologist and registered nurse and oversees the motion sickness desensitization program at the University of North Dakota's aerospace program. It's a 3-day course now that's available to the public. That's tomorrow on Main Street, and we hope you'll join us again.